And now, live from New York City via Los Angeles, California, it's time for The View from Over Here with the man who has a view for all seasons, your host, Stan Weisleder.
Okay, we got the finger. That means we're ready to rock and roll. This is Stan Weisleder on The View from Over Here. And with me in the studio today is our producer and once in a while co-host, Malcolm Berman.
Once in a while?
Well, all the while. And we have a special guest with us today. I'm just introduce him by name, Cameron Cubison, and he will talk a lot later, and we will ask him a lot of questions later, and we will naturally try to trip him up. Okay, now, for some of you people out there, I understand that we had a YouTube problem with last week's podcast. Not on all YouTubes. Maybe your YouTube, but not my YouTube. Anyway, if you did get a garbled YouTube last week, you can tune in to MalcolmDigitalRadio.com. Don't forget the .com. We're there as are a couple of other stations or programs, and you can hear whatever you want to hear, whatever part of it, prior weeks, prior whatever, anytime, any place. It's always there at your fingertips.
And you can't get rid of it. Forever
yes.
and ever.
It's
stays
there forever until we have an apocalypse or whatever.
Which might happen soon.
Yes. Now, last week, I started at our producer's suggestion to read sections of a book that I wrote.
And you're stuck with listening to it.
So once
we
started.
By the way, also, since you're into the film business, we're thinking about converting that into a screenplay.
Okay, I'll take note.
Anyway, last week I just read the introduction. And from what I've heard from a few people that have called in, and they said, hey, it sounds pretty damn good. You know what? I read the book before, but it sounds a lot better when someone reads it.
Especially with you, the way you have put the feeling into it.
Well, I know where the emphasis should be. When you read something, you're going to scan quick and read it quick, and maybe it sinks and maybe it doesn't.
But there were some key words that you used that we could not use on regular radio.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I have to tell you, this book holds a Guinness record for the F word and its derivatives, more than in any other book that has been written. It was not intentional. It just came out that way because that's the way a lot of people talk. I know I talk that way. I try not to, but I do. Anyway, it's in here 374 times.
Wow.
Okay? That is a Guinness record.
I think it was Norman Mailer, or one of the books I remember years ago reading, and they used the word fug, F-U-G.
Fug
you.
That was the other guy, Jones, when he wrote From Here to Eternity. He used the word fug, F-U-G.
Yeah, fug
you. Yeah.
That's a good word.
Well, I'll give you a better one. Marilyn, my wife, when I first met her, she wouldn't use anything. She would say, job you. Okay? Now she says the real thing.
Well, job you was basically, she was referring to Steve Jobs.
This was before Steve Jobs. I don't know if Steve Jobs was even born at that time. Anyway, let's get back to the book. The name of the title is The Trees, and it has absolutely nothing to do about trees because it is a euphemism. It is a euphemism for life because if we didn't have trees, we wouldn't have life. Think about it. Trees gave us fuel, shelter,
right.
Food, and so forth.
And beautiful photography.
Paper.
And paper.
Yes.
And oxygen.
And everything else that you could think of.
Not necessarily in that order. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you realize that I read something like 80% of the world's oxygen comes from the forest in Brazil.
Probably.
And they're trying to knock that down. So we'll kill ourselves.
Well,
before Donald can.
Profits are more important. So people need profits. So they just chop away.
Was Moses a prophet?
Well, so was whatever.
Go read.
Okay, this is chapter one. Like I said, last week we just did the intro. And each chapter has a heading. And the way I write a book is a chapter is almost a little story unto itself. I've seen many books where chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4, I think they're just points at which the writer said it's enough. I'll have to go to the next chapter, otherwise this chapter will be too long. I don't use that technique. Like I said, it's like almost a little story within the story.
So we could take that out and do a movie in that, just the chapter?
Well, maybe. You probably could. A short film. Okay, this chapter, like I said, chapter one, and it is entitled Betsy Head Park. It was after the Memorial Day weekend, just a couple of weeks before school let out. The guys flexed their muscles and took advantage of the early days of summer to work on their tans. Stretched out on the concrete, soaking up the rays of the sun whenever it peeked out from behind the clouds, were Ringo, Mongoose, Scumbag, Pot Cheese, and Shitman. Betsy Head Park, a byproduct of President Roosevelt's Work Progress Administration that opened up to the public in 1939, sprawled out over three city blocks. From Strauss Street on the west to Hopkinson Avenue on the east, and from Livonia Avenue with its L on the south to Dumont Avenue on the north. It was an oasis of recreational activities run by the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation. Its centerpiece was made up of a swimming pool 100 meters long and 50 meters wide, with an average depth of 3.5 feet, and a separate diving pool with 5 diving boards whose dimensions were 10 by 50 meters and a depth of 15 feet. The cost of admission was 10 cents for children and 25 cents for those over the age of 12. Next to the swimming pool complex, there was a full-size athletic field surrounded by a quarter-mile cinder track and a dozen or more handball courts. During the summer months, the swimming pool complex served as a mecca at which to see or be seen. The cost of admission was the same what it would cost for most of the local movie houses, like the Ambassador, Stadium, Stone, Loewy's Palace, and Loewy's Premier. The Loewy's Pitkin was in a different category, costing all of 50 cents. Now I'm going to jump ahead a bit because I don't want to spend too much time on a lot of the extrapolation and so forth. I'll just get to the point where we're getting to the conversation between the guys.
Get to the sex scene. That's what I do when I read the book.
There's no sex.
I want to get to the good part.
I have to tell you one of the greatest compliments I ever had about this book. This guy was reading it while on the treadmill. He's on a treadmill. No, correction. It was not a treadmill. It was a bicycle exercise. He was able to sit and read at the same time. The best compliment I ever got. He said he got an enormous erection or hard-on when he was reading the lesbian sequence. I said, wow. I didn't know that it went over so big with guys.
My next question is, why do guys like watching lesbians, but they don't like watching two guys?
I never met
a straight guy who likes watching men.
Yeah, nor did I.
but for women?
Sign me on.
See what this show is all about?
I do. I'm getting the vibe.
I've gotten lots of compliments, but nothing as good as that one. At least I think it's fantastic.
That's pretty crystallized. Yeah, you did something right.
And you know what? And I made it up. I never really witnessed anything like that. I just used my imagination the way I thought it should be if it was happening.
And no one uses that. Okay, how do you rate it? I rate that book 5 hard-ons out of
Let's get down to the conversations with the guys. Now, again, these are the guys that grow up. They're in about 14 years of age now. They grow up with the girls. And, again, I should have said at the very beginning, the main thrust of the story is that they make it to Las Vegas.
Now don't give away the story.
No, this is just a quick overview. They get there in time to witness and participate in the change from the mob to Howard Hughes to corporate America, which is what we have now today running Vegas. Corporate
and everything
America.
Else. Yeah.
Okay?
Yes, Bernie.
So the guys are laying down. Let's get back. They're putting on their suntan oil and are laying on the concrete and getting into conversation. Look at the way those clouds change shape, said Ringo as he followed them with his finger. Clouds are made up of drops of water that collect on dust in the air, said Potcheese. Did you know that? Shit, man, said Shitman. What are the clouds doing now? Asked Scumbag. They're changing shape, said Ringo. The one up there looks like a giraffe. A giraffe? What's it doing? Asked Scumbag. Now it's on top of that other cloud, said Ringo. The first cloud reminds me of Scumbag's mother, said Mongoose. What's that thing hanging down from its middle? Asked Shitman. It's touching the first cloud, said Potcheese. Uh-oh, commented Ringo. Is that what I think it is? Oh, no, I think it's humping the first cloud, said Shitman. Yeah, it looks like it's humping Scumbag's mother, said Mongoose. Are you sure that's what it's doing? Asked Potcheese. Well, they all laughed at the expense of Scumbag. When they were through making fun of him, they ran off and dove headlong into the shallow pool. Those who could went over to the diving pool and showed off on the 3-meter board, first with swan dives, followed by jackknives, half gainers, and lastly, a 1.5 somersault. The girls, those who could, showed off in the latest import from France, the bikini. Oh, Bev, I don't know. Everything shows. And with yours, half your ass sticks out. My God. It's supposed to, Eunice. Don't be so chicken. My mother would kill me. What she doesn't know won't hurt. And with those parting words of wisdom, Eunice and Beverly left their clothes with the locker attendant and put the elastic strap with the key on their wrists. They gave each other one last look over before they braved the outside. I'll jump ahead again.
Okay.
Just to shorten the...
Excitement.
Yes. I don't want you to get too worked up. Hey, called out Mongoose.
I'm waiting for the lesbian scene.
Yeah, me too.
No, that's in way, that's like in part two of the... No, it's either in part two or part three.
Okay.
Oh, one thing, real quick aside, because this book has so much in it and a lot of people and a lot of things happening, at the very end I have a table of contents, chapter by chapter, so you have the name of the chapter and briefly, like in a couple of words, so you know where to look for something if you want to
look. So we can search for the lesbian scene. Right,
absolutely, right. Absolutely.
I've been binge-watching Game of Thrones on it's HBO Go. You want to get confused about names and people. I don't know if either of you have seen the series, but they have so many families and so many names, you know, uncommon names that you can't remember.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, they have a lot of naked women.
What I don't like about that program? Every time you get to like one of the main characters, they get killed.
But that's what makes it interesting.
Well, I don't know. I like a character. I don't want it to get killed right away.
I can understand that. You get emotionally attached to these people.
Let's get on to a real book. Oh, one other thing. Okay. Everything in this book happened. Maybe not in the same sequence.
Or the same people.
You have to change names. I changed names like if anybody was still alive. And if I said anything negative, change the name. If I said something positive, I left the name, the real name.
So you changed your name to protect the guilty.
There you go. Absolutely.
Read on.
Today, Beverly and Eunice had one up on all of them. No sooner than they stepped out onto the deck, the wolf calls and whistles started. Hey, called out Mongoose. Is that Beverly and Eunice? Get a load of those bathing suits. Ringo, look at Eunice. Who cares and why are you telling me? Shitman, wow, said Shitman. Do you think they'll walk this way, asked Scumbag. That would be nice, giggled Potcheese, but they're walking the other way. Beverly walked with her head up high. She ate it up, as she thought. Best $15 I ever spent.
$15 for a bikini?
Well, back then. Yeah. Eunice, not used to the notoriety that Beverly craved, tiptoed behind her. When she realized that most of the wolf calls and whistles were for her, she remembered what Beverly said to her. The guys are going to want to fuck you in the worst way. And quickly hastened her pace. Come on, slowpoke, said Beverly as she squirmed with the bottom portion of her bikini to get more comfortable. Let's go to the diving pool. Are you kidding? What if this thing comes off? So? And who says we have to jump or dive in? All we have to do is slowly walk by. A well-tanned young man with black, slick back hair who looked like he was in his early 20s, Eunice referred to him as an older guy, propositioned her in unmistakable words. Honey, I would just love to fuck you, causing her to tremble inside. She came to the realization that she was in the wrong place at the wrong time and in the wrong bathing suit. Bev, I want to go home. God, such a party pooper. Before Eunice could protest any further, Beverly grabbed her by the arm. There's someone I want you to meet. Tommy DiMeglio. Quit school when he was 16 and went to work in his old man's store. Don't know what he does, but he always has lots of money in his pocket. He's not Jewish. He's Italian. No kidding. And what about Ringo? He's Italian. Listen to me. When you get married, you marry a Jewish guy. When you get laid, you go out with an Italian, one that makes money. Where did you hear that? From my sister, Cynthia. As soon as Tommy spotted Beverly, he and his two friends, Rocco and Funzie, swaggered in her direction. But his eyes were on Eunice. Hi, Tommy. Yo, Beverly. What's with this yo stuff? Can't you say hi or hello like a regular person? Hey, that's the way I talk. And who's your friend? Tommy, Eunice. Eunice, Tommy. And those are his two bodyguards, Rocco and Funzie. Don't mind them. Rocco and Funzie were used to it. They were also about 16 and looked up to Tommy, who only had to motion with his eyes for them to move back out of earshot. You're cute, and you have a nice pair of eyes. They're blue. I can see myself drowning in those blue eyes. Tommy stared at Eunice, not letting up, waiting to see who would blink first. She did. Just like with the older guy who said, honey, I would just love to fuck you, she trembled inside when she heard Tommy's words. In the first instance, it was revulsion, but this time she didn't know. Beverly, I really want to go home. Tommy, it was nice meeting you and your friends. Sorry, Tommy, we gotta go. Eunice is kind of bashful. You know, she needs more time. She can take all the time she needs. I'm very patient.
End of chapter one.
And so ends chapter uno, chapter
very
one.
Very good. Just a short story reminded me of what you were reading. Back in the, I had a shared a house out in Fire Island in the, I think it was the early 80s. And when topless sunbathing was very popular, in fact, even nude sunbathing. And you get there, you know, you leave work on a Friday at 12 o'clock. You take the Long Island Railroad. You take the ferry. You go there. Generally, they have on Friday night, they have what's a five-ish or a six-ish, and you have parties, and you meet people.
Yeah.
They're part of there. So, you know, you'd meet this girl that you were attracted to, and you would have drinks with her and, you know, just talk. And the next day, you'd go to the beach, and she walks up to say hello, and she's topless. And it's how do you maintain eye contact? You know, oh, yeah, you have to lift up your head.
When that happened with you, were you disheartened or pleased?
No, I was nervous.
Okay, that's a truthful answer.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, you know, I was like, in my 20s, in my late 20s, even though, okay, don't show any. Okay, don't rise. Stay down.
Stay
you're,
put.
You're at the beach.
All right, let's stop talking about ourselves. I want to introduce our special guest today.
Special guest.
Okay, he's not special.
The bar must be low, but I'll take it.
Right. Well, okay, his name is Cameron Cubison. He's the co-founder of an organization called ScreenCraft. And what does ScreenCraft do? It promotes the creation and marketing and selling and whatever regarding screenplays. How are we involved with this? Well, back in 1999, there was an organization called the National Screenwriters Conference. My company became a sponsor of that organization maybe 2 years after it started. I'll tell you quickly what the first year was like. We got a call from the guy who was running it. His name is Gary Haber, who passed away a couple of years ago. In fact, when he passed away, they showed his picture and they told all about him with the country award thing.
Country Western.
Yeah, whatever they did out of Las Vegas. And I was surprised to see they really gave him a nice send-off. Anyway, he said, why don't you become a sponsor of this organization? I said, why? What do they do? Why should I? Why should I spend the money? Well, for one thing, you'll get to come to Nashville and have a great time because we do blah, 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 blah.
But you had to take, you had to take your wife or you went single?
No, we went. I took Marilyn. Mindy came, took her kids. You know, the whole all of the execs, owners of the company went to see what it was like. And I remember the very first day we check into the hotel and they said, we're meeting in the cellar. Oh, geez, we're meeting in a cellar. The cellar was a nightclub. I didn't know at the time, okay? Then we go to this meeting, that and that and that. And then on Saturday night, well, this starts on a Thursday, okay? And it ends on Sunday. On Saturday night, we were invited to the studio, which was a great big barn used by Dun & Brooks. And we were totally blown away by that whole event because it was like a country song fest with all kinds of name artists that live in or around Nashville. They called it a guitar pull. I had never heard that expression before.
A guitar pull.
Because all of the guys, they would come. And these are people a lot of us never heard of, but in Nashville, they were big. Okay. Anyway, there were other organizations involved. And all of it is under the umbrella of the Nashville Film Festival. So now you have the Nashville Writers Conference and ScreenCraft, which are part of the National Film Festival. And our guest today, Cameron, is representing ScreenCraft. A little bit more about Cameron. He's been a student at USC, UCLA, New York Film Academy, and Chapman University, where he studied, guess what? Film, screenplays, and everything related thereto.
Was that Emerson also?
Emerson, yeah, a whole laundry list. I didn't
There's
fit in
too
anywhere,
many.
So.
It would take a whole hour if we listed all of his credits.
I took whoever who would take me at the time. So
there you go. Cameron, so how are you today, and how do you feel?
A little out of place, but happy to be in the air-conditioned room and not reading a screenplay for an hour. So.
What do you have for the people that are going to Nashville this year?
We're doing the Nashville Writers Conference, which is this is our first year, as you pointed out, where it's sort of the torch has been passed to us to re-energize this great event for 2016, and it's a 3-day conference, April 20th through the 22nd.
And where will it be? What hotel or?
Yeah, just right in the heart of Music City, at the Regal Cinemas. That's like their big downtown theater, and you know, it's going to be a great opportunity to tour the town. We've got a Grand Ole Opry tour built in, and so it's designed for locals and people who've never been. I've never been to Nashville before, but it's
never. Okay, you'll like it.
What are Nashville writers, or what?
Well, I mean, the program is for writers from all over the world, and it's specifically a screenwriting conference.
We're
assembling, you know, a whole laundry list of A-list Hollywood screenwriters and literary managers and producers to come and do a sort of concentrated symposium on various topics. And and be a great networking event for writers of all, you know.
That's what Gary Haber tried to do. He wanted to create a, I think the word is symbiosis, between Nashville and Hollywood. Hollywood providing the movies and the screenwriting generally, and Nashville providing the musical backgrounds.
Yeah, and that Nashville just idea. Having such a great, vibrant, creative community, the music scene. They've got a big, as I understand it, a faith-based filmmaking, you know, community, and faith-based film is huge now in Hollywood. I mean, the suits smell the money on that. That's why every 3 weeks we're getting, you know, a new faith-based. Yeah. It's a whole new audience for people, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a synergy between Hollywood and Nashville, and we're excited about bringing those two communities
synergy,
together.
Synergy, that's the word synergy. I really wanted to use.
That's why I make the big money.
Now, what happens when, you know, you said it's international? Do you read scripts from other countries, from in other languages? Let's say someone has a Frenchman has a script written in French, or you know, an Israeli has it in Hebrew. How do you
we read internationally, but it has to be in English. My high school Spanish is growing rustier and rustier with every passing day, and I only speak English and bad English fluently, so it has to be in English. But we do read scripts from all over the world.
So are you one of the people that judges scripts?
I am. I'm sort of, you know, ScreenCraft does screenplay consulting. We also do a whole suite of genre-specific screenplay competitions where we bring in, you know, judges and jury members to weigh in on the top scripts. I'm the guy that takes the, you know, 700 or 1,000 scripts we get for every contest, and with my team we narrow it down to, you know, top 20 and then a top 10 and a top 5, and that's what gets passed along to the judges to weigh in on sort of what their thoughts are.
Malcolm, when I used to go to the National Screenwriters Conferences that were sponsored by Gary Haber and his people, they had classes, and the classes or seminars were run by some of them were college professors that taught screenplay writing. Some of them were biggies from the industry in California. Mm-hmm. They could be producers, other successful writers, directors, and the classes were filled to capacity.
So there's two questions. How do we find out how to reach you if you're a budding screenwriter, and how do we find out about the conference? Where do we reach?
The quick and easy answer is just go to screencraft.org, specifically for the conference, screencraft.org/NWC for Nashville Writers Conference. Everything's on there, contact information, all of our offerings, our consulting, our contests. It's a one-stop shop.
You can also go to the umbrella heading or the umbrella org, Nashville Film Festival, and it will have,
it'll have
his company and everything else. And with nice pictures and so forth.
Now, how long have you been associated with them?
With ScreenCraft?
Yeah.
We started it about 4 years ago, 2012.
Do you have any success stories that you could tell, or is it still a little
too early? Sure, absolutely. We've gotten about 15 writers signed in the last 18 months based on scripts that were discovered through our contests and through our consulting, and we work to, you know, through our programs to, if they weren't L.A. local writers, to fly them out here to set them up with manager meetings, agent meetings, producer meetings, drawing on sort of the contacts that I have and my partner John Rhodes has. And
but have any of them resulted in actual completed productions that are well-known?
Is anything coming to a theater near us? Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, so they're still in works.
Still in the infancy, right? The average screenplay that gets produced takes about 6 years of development, so it's a long game.
Now, do you charge a certain consulting rate, or do you take a percentage of the film, or how do you work your
fees? We do a flat entry fee if you're entering one of our contests. We do a flat consulting fee. We do not take a sort of percentage in your intellectual property or your screenplay or your project, with the exception of our short film production fund, which we launched late last year, and that's a co-venture between ScreenCraft and a hedge fund, a media fund in Beverly Hills called Bondit. And that program, every quarter, every 3 months, we pick a screenplay to award a production grant up to $20,000 to go make a short film. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we're interested in feature adaptation potential, other medium potential, and we'll make a custom deal with the filmmaker to take a percentage if one of those adaptations comes to pass, because we want to stay involved. We want to stay involved with those filmmakers, help them make that adaptation, help them get it financed, help them get it produced.
Are you involved with any particular a production group or movie company or university?
No, we're totally, you know, agnostic, platform agnostic. We're, you know, independent. We've got good relationships with you know, different companies.
You said agnostic, but not atheist.
Not atheist. at least, you know, not when it comes to screenplays. We won't talk religion and politics. That's a different conversation.
That's what we learned way, way, way back when you were with people, even people who you know well, never bring up politics or religion.
Yeah.
But I do it anyway because I like the rapport,
it's
the
fun.
Action.
It's fun.
My secret to having a good relation with my in-laws is simple. My wife is from El Salvador. I don't speak Spanish. I cannot talk to my mother-in-law about politics or religion. I can talk about food, about whether I'm hot or cold, but I can't talk about religion and politics.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss.
And for 22 years, we've been fine.
So that's why you're great friends.
You're right. Now, for you personally, do you write? Are you a writer? Or is that your goals?
Well, I was. I've, you know, like so many other people in this town, I've written spec screenplays, and I wrote a few projects on assignment for some really, really low-rent producers out here because I needed the money. And but these days, no. Reading full-time is what I do. And you know,
does it get boring or monotonous? Because I imagine I've known so many people – old friend, oh, I'm working on a screenplay.
Yeah, everybody's
Jesus.
Working on one.
What bullshit. You know, everybody and his uncle is trying to. They look at it and they think, oh, that's so easy. I could do that. Bullshit.
Well,
It's not easy.
That's the great irony. I think everybody thinks writing a screenplay is, oh, I've got a great idea for a movie. You know, movies, they're the populist art form. It's what everybody watches. Everybody wants to be in the industry. And I think there's this myth that, you know, well, it's not like a novel. It's only 100 or 110 pages.
No, it's a snap.
How hard is that? It's so much harder. It's a specific art form. The formatting is so specific. The market is so specific.
Well, I used to do documentaries in the old days, Another Life in New York.
Yeah.
But the documentaries in those days had no channels for distribution because the networks didn't take it.
Right.
Because they only did their own documentaries.
In-house, yeah.
And then there was no theatrical distribution.
Because there was no market for
right.
it. Right. Now there is.
Right. So basically the only people that saw the documentaries that I did were the people that agreed with me. And who the hell did I need that audience?
Yep, you already had them.
I wanted to change the world. Uh-huh. And you can't change the world by people that agree with you.
And
you
the
have
world
to go
did
to,
not change. Right. In fact, it got worse.
But now, actually, Stan and I are working on a screenplay now. We want to do but I'm looking into the media like Netflix. That is
digital distribution has changed the entire business. Yeah.
And Netflix, now from now I binge watch. Mm-hmm. Like I do. I did House of Cards last year. I think I did 5 years in 2 weeks.
Yep.
Same thing I'm doing now, Game of Thrones.
It's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's there. It's, I do 2-3 hours each night.
Yeah, well, it's like a drug. You get hooked on it, and the supply is there. The danger is something
you
burn
through it all.
I
started the House of Cards a couple of months ago on plane trips. I'd get 5 or 6 episodes on a trans-country. Yeah.
And no commercials.
Whatever. Yeah. Well, in a way, you get the commercials because you have to go through the beginning and the end when they show the credits.
Recaps.
Before and end, and then they give you a little history of what happened 5, you know, issues before. But still, you get it all in one sitting until you fall asleep.
Well, so far, my favorite of the last 2 years has been Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
That was so well made, and the story so interweaved with each other. It was not boring.
It was, and it was a show that on paper had a very specific, even a niche audience, you know, the BBC audience, the sort of – but it crossed over to so many markets.
Did
Everybody
you watch
got hooked on that
the
show.
One about the Selfridge department store?
I haven't seen that yet.
That one is very
Jeremy
good.
Jeremy Piven, yeah. I hear
it's
great.
It's more lively than the other one.
Well, the other one was actually very lively, the things that happened, because it wasn't events, it was people, relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And you get involved with the people.
And that's what you can do on TV, which you can't really do a lot in feature films anymore, at least at the studio level, you know, do movies about relationships and movies about people.
Movies, too many movies these days. They need the obligatory
Car crash.
Car scene chase.
Yeah, well, it's a
multiple homicides.
Mm-hmm. It's a different mentality now, you know. It's very corporate. Studios are just one revenue stream in a sea of, you know, you got Time Warner, you got Disney, you got...
They don't concentrate on the story like they used
to. Make one movie that makes $2 billion worldwide than make 10 movies that make, you know, decent money across the board.
You know what, I have to tell you,
they want to put their eggs in one basket.
A couple of months ago, I happened to watch a rerun of a movie that I remember seeing as a kid, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
Mm, I know it.
Gene Tierney and Rex Harrison. And I know I saw it many years ago. Oh, I'll watch it for a couple of minutes. And I was amazed at the way the story was written and the words and the dialogue. And I'm saying to myself, you don't get this today.
Yeah. Well, a problem with movies is the markets now, in order to make money back, it almost has to be an international market. And
that's
international,
so
it's less words and more action.
And in fact, the domestic market, especially for big movies, is an afterthought. It's all about international. Yeah. Domestic is such a small part of the pie. You know, I mean, look at a movie. I always point to this. You know, we have these big Marvel Comics movies now. There's a franchise called Captain America. It has America in the title. It opens in 25 foreign markets before it opens in America.
Because they make their money back.
Including the Mideast?
Yeah. I don't know about that, but it comes to us late. And yeah, they come in, they've already made most of their money back internationally, and domestic is a very small part of
it. Well, and even domestic, they're catering towards a younger audience, mm-hmm. because I know myself, even if I love a movie, I see it once.
Yeah.
And generally, I don't buy popcorn.
Because some movies I've seen a number of times that I really like.
That you go to?
No. I'll pay only once.
Right.
I'll see it on TV. Like one time, I think I told you about that time when my granddaughter was on the same soccer team with the Tom Cruise's daughter. Yeah. And so briefly, real talk at the end, I said, hi. And I introduced myself and... Oh, yeah. I said, I know you. You're one of those actor guys.
You're an actor.
I figure I'll pull his chain a bit.
Yeah.
And he looked at me like, oh, wow, who's this guy? He doesn't know who the hell I am. Then I said, oh, no, don't relax. In fact, one of your movies I've seen 10 times. Oh, really? What is that? The Last Samurai. I love that movie.
Yeah.
And whenever it's on TV, I'll watch it.
Yeah. Right, but you won't. But you pay
$15. I won't pay again for it. No.
The kids pay the $15. Plus, from what I understand, most of the theaters make their money off of the goodies. The goodies.
Sure.
The concessions. The upsells and the experience. There's a whole market now for adults where you'll pay $30 for a movie ticket because you can sit in pre-picked leather seats and
you can lie down and go to sleep if you like, and they'll feed you.
And a lot of the movies they're making now, you know, you need to drink as much as you can to get through it. So it's a good, you know.
There's one movie that also I've watched, I don't know how many times, a number of times, paid for it only once. Hmm. And I saw it one year when we went to to Nashville. We had some time off. Said, let's go to a movie. And we went to see this movie. I was so impressed
with it.
The Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven.
Now, I'm not religious. I'm as far from being religious as anybody on this planet. And this film, you might say, it's not anti-religion, but it's, I would say, definitely anti-Catholic.
Yeah.
Incredible film about the Crusades. And whenever I catch it on TV, if I'm lucky, I'll get it at the beginning while channel surfing. I'll sit and watch it. And I forgot how many times I've seen it. I'm enthralled when I watch that movie.
There are
and
some
I
movies
have only,
like that.
You know what my complaint about it is? It's too short. I would love to have seen it longer.
There's a longer version of the movie you can watch.
There is?
They released it on video a couple years ago.
You have to give me that info.
I will.
I want to see that version.
There's certain movies I love watching. Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman's a fun one.
I love that one.
That was good.
Ghosts.
Good. Great movie.
The old one, Casablanca, I'll see it every time it's on.
Yeah,
I've lost count on that one. But you know something? I stopped to think about it a minute, which I tried to do and I did. If you close your eyes and just listen to the music, okay, and then start to open your eyes, you will realize that an integral part of this movie is the music. Yeah. And without that
Max
music,
yeah,
I don't think it would have been as successful.
Most every movie now is with a musical. Most movies. Like, well, Casablanca is particularly because you have As Time Goes By with Dooley Wilson. But you also have La Marseillaise. When he
A short sequence.
No. When he comes into the listen to it. It's always when something patriotic has they played the Marseillaise, and then when Paul Heinrich goes in the bar and
in Germany. Henry.
I don't know, but anyway, Paul goes in there.
The guy with the cigarettes.
Yeah. No, that was another.
That was another movie. Okay.
That was the Bette Davis movie. Where he lights the two cigarettes. Yeah. And did that for years.
Yeah. Good old Betty Davis. No, but the lesson
didn't
with Casablanca.
Didn't he die of lung cancer?
He did. Yeah, everybody. Yeah. No, the lesson with Casablanca is you're right. The music is such an integral part, and it's because it's layered specifically into the story.
Right.
You know.
Well, I was watching on TV the other day, Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
With John Wayne.
John Wayne.
And there the Marine hymn plays, constantly. And that gives a story when the battle.
You know, John Agar was in that movie.
Yeah.
He plays the young recruit or whatever. I saw him at not too long ago. That's back when I was with the sheriff's department. We had a detail where these people came to sell their mementos. And he was there selling pictures of himself autographed when he was back doing those movies with John Wayne and everybody else. You wouldn't recognize him. He really shrunken in. It was no resemblance at all between the guy who I saw and the one who you saw up on the screen.
You wouldn't recognize me if you saw me 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. Well, some people retain their looks, sort of, kind of. But some people...
Some with chemical help.
I wanted to mention something to you. I read in the paper, since you're a big Dodger fan.
Yeah.
Don Drysdale's widow is selling all his... memorabilia at auction.
I'm not interested.
But you can
stuff.
Have no. The ring was only like about $15,000.
Well, you might. You have more money than I do. So
you can buy an old uniform that's unwashed.
No thanks. I'll pass.
But anyway, getting back to what you're doing with your company. So, how do you find the industry now as far as the talent for young writers? Are the people coming to you young, old, in between? Do you get a lot of college kids coming?
Yeah, it's a total cross-stitch. We get college kids. We get septuagenarians with great scripts. You know, I think it's an art form that isn't specific to any one demographic, any one age range. Everybody wants to try it. I've worked with some quote-unquote retirees that have written some of the best stuff I've read because they've had life experience, they've got time on their hands, they've got disposable income, and they have stories to tell.
You know, when I was to go to when we were going all the years to the National Screenwriters Conference, one of the people who would participate was a big record producer in Nashville, okay?
Yeah.
And one of his relatives would always take the classes. And he was an older guy, probably older than me, and that makes him pretty old. I don't know that he ever sold anything because I never seen anything with his name, but he was there every year religiously taking those classes.
Well, that's an important note, too. It's you can't be in it to make that sale. I mean, obviously, that's what everybody wants, but... You know, selling a screenplay, it's not that different from winning the lottery. It's so many variables have to happen. So you have to be in it because you love the process of writing. You can't be in it because you're looking for that quick sale, that quick rise. It's not a sure thing.
Well, now also the way movies are done are, of course, major studios, you see all the trucks out there and the people going, you know, you see people, assistant to an assistant to an assistant.
Yeah, it's the...
And someone just lays down the tape.
The credits are 10 minutes long, yeah.
But I think it was...
Now they show credits. It takes about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I remember years and years ago, it was like one or two pages of... one or two shots. One page with credits, and maybe that's all you got. Yeah. Then it got to be two pages worth. Yep. And now they scroll down hundreds of names.
Well, at the end, you see, assistant to the
custodian
doing
assistant.
The bathrooms.
Yeah.
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 Just about.
Yeah. But also, like with some of the cheaper movies, I think it was Edward Burns produced his own movie using a Canon.
Yeah. Ed Burns was kind of on the forefront of doing do-it-yourself, low-budget indie filmmaking. He was one of those guys.
People have told me that you can use one of the Canons if you read the book, read the manual, and you could take up results. You get results that are practically like with an Arriflex or any one of those real cameras.
Yeah, well, even more than that, people are making movies now, feature films on their cell phone cameras.
One of the big
festival successes from last year at Sundance and was a movie called Tangerine that was shot on an iPhone.
Okay. Well, there's an offshoot of that. Years ago, I used to produce commercials in New York, and you would shoot on 35mm, and you would get that reduced to you would put that on 2-inch tape. Which basically, took a football field, and then you would edit it on the 2-inch tape. So you go into the editing room, and there was a big thing there, and it took like 12, 14 hours to edit, to do a minute solid commercial.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember a movie. You know the actor? I think his name is Edward Burns.
Yeah,
that's what we're talking about.
Okay,
yeah.
Same guy, actor, filmmaker.
Same guy.
Yeah.
All right. I think his first movie was A Homemade Job. Something about an Irish family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the Mulligan.
Brothers McMullen.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And
that's a good movie.
It was supposed to have been done on 16mm film, because I remember reading an article. And when he was able to sell it, they had to upgrade it to, I guess, 35mm so it could be shown in the movies.
Yeah. So, well, then everything now all the I don't think theaters use 35mm anymore.
Only specialty theaters. Yeah, it's digital intermediates.
So everything is digital now.
Everything is digital, except for the few influential filmmakers fighting to keep film alive. That's Chris Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, a couple other guys. But
I remember doing as I say, going back to my story, I used to do commercials, which took a huge amount of money and a huge amount of time. About 6-7 years ago, or maybe 10 years ago, I did a commercial, 30-second commercial, and we had absolutely no budget.
Yeah.
And all we had was, like, still shots. It was the Tahana singer, and I'm forgetting her name, the one that was killed by her, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I know absolutely nothing about music.
Anyway, so all I had was still shots and her videos of her shows, but no budget to do it in.
Yeah.
So someone had recommended this guy who went to his garage, and he had this computer, and he entered all the elements that I had in the computer. He said, "What do you want now?" And I said, "I would think, okay, I want the title over here, blah, blah, blah." I go, "Ch-ch-ch, next." He did it faster than I could think.
And all of this is no budget.
Right. No, but I think it cost me like $100. I had a 30-second commercial that looked good. But it's amazing. Times they are changing. Well, even this show now that we have, I don't know whether this is radio. I mean, because we have the webcam on.
Yeah.
And eventually, I'm going to be able to cut film into it, even though Aaron's not going to be able to edit it for me.
That's a dig. Is he asleep back there, or is he eating a ham sandwich
be.
But because soon, like if you talk about your film festival, right? We say, okay, let's see what happened last year. We just put the film in,
right?
I can edit it, but not here. And we could say, stop it, and then.
Cameron, next year I plan to go. This year I found out about it like only last week from Alicia that it's happening. Wow, right now.
Yeah, we've been flying by the seat of our pants a little bit and coordinating everything. So, come next year,
After
Definitely we've worked out the inevitable kinks.
This year, I just didn't have enough advance
when
notice.
When is it?
April 20th through the 22nd.
Oh.
That's this year.
That's this year.
Oh, that's another 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Next year will be a different
time. Do you still have
room
for people to come?
Sure, we sure do.
Give us again your website.
Screencraft.org/NWC. For the conference information.
And what if someone wants to contact you directly? Use that same address?
Yeah, or screencraft.org. It's got our phone number. It's got my email. It's got, our telekinetic portal, everything you need.
Have you written any books on the subject?
No, I have written absolutely no books. You're the book writer.
No, I was talking about instructional manuals, like how-to. This is not a how-to book.
Oh, well, I've edited them. I've not written them. So,
how would you go about if I wanted to sell the screen rights to that book?
It's all dependent on the book and what kind of value the IP supposedly has. What kind of audience already exists for the material? That's going to dictate how you make that deal. If it's a book that has an audience that's in demand, you've got more leverage. If it's a book that nobody's read, then you should lie and try to fabricate that everybody's read it. You can do that.
Well, does your company do that?
No, that's above my pay grade.
Oh, speaking of lying, I got to tell you this story because I was going to put this in the Weekly Blast.
Okay.
A guy that I grew up with, he's not in the book, okay, but one of the guys.
That's going to be your next book.
No, I don't want to write about him. He was a good guy, nice guy. And he has a son a lot younger than him, obviously, but they look like brothers. As soon as I saw him on TV.
Kind of like Kirk Douglas and Michael Douglas now.
More so.
Yeah.
Anyway, the kid wrote a book called Found. I think that was the name. And it was about finding things on the street, notes that somebody left. And he correlated, got all of this stuff together. Like his father says, all this shit. I send this kid to an expensive school, and all he does, he's making a lot of money, more than I ever did, by collecting junk. Okay. Anyway, I find out that the kid just wrote an article that was in this past Sunday's L.A. Times. So I see his name. Well, let me read it. So I read the article. He's an excellent writer, writes well. And the story is about CrowdSource. Mm. Okay? I had heard about this before, but he went and embedded himself, by himself, into an organization where you go to them, and if you want people to go to your... Let's say you're running for president. You want people to show good signs or knock you down or whatever. They plant people in whatever kind of audience you want, lying. Let's say if it's a book you want to promote. They'll go to all kinds of conferences and conventions. Plants.
It's known as primaries.
Say,
the primaries, which
yes, is, primaries, right.
I mean, but Donald's talking about everybody is planting protesters. The protesters are doing Donald.
It's all an orchestrated show. It's all nonsense.
Yeah.
All of it.
But the thing that I, what I sort of get ticked off on in this whole thing that's going on, everything is national. So the Hill Speak in Wisconsin will hear it. Mm-hmm. Hill Speak in Nashville will hear it. And they always repeat the same thing. All of the until now. Now they're starting to talk about new things. But for the first 4 months, you would hear Donald. He would say the same thing over and over again.
Same angles, the same talking points.
We all heard it.
Well, it worked. Well, you know, I thought he would really make it, but I think he shot himself in the foot twice. But he is his own worst enemy.
He is.
Truly.
But it should be interesting with if he does not get the nomination, what happens? If he can't get
I think Hillary will win.
But I mean, what happens in the Republican Party?
Well, they're going to be finished.
And will Hillary win? Will Hillary be nominated?
Well, I think the only thing that might stop her is if she gets indicted. But I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't.
If she gets indicted, can we vote for somebody that's indicted in prison?
I don't know. I don't know.
Can we have the Oval Office in county jail?
Malcolm, I have no clue.
It's not that much of a stretch.
Yeah. Most of the officials are in jail.
Well, Cameron, let me ask you. You're in the business. Would that make an interesting topic? Has anybody presented that idea to you? Because in the past, there have been some very good films, political films. I remember the one that was done with, what's his name? Robert.
Redford.
Redford, right.
The candidate.
The candidate. Right. that was good.
It was.
There were some others, but that one rings the most in my mind.
The one about Huey Long was...
The
name.
That was...
All the President... Well, not all the
King's
President,
Men.
All the King's Men.
That was the original one with Broderick Crawford.
Right, and then they remade it with Sean Penn to disastrous results.
Yeah.
And what's the one... Well, it's not political, the one with Andy Griffith, where he... He plays the
All
country
singer. All in the
singer.
Crowd or something about the
voice
crowd.
In the crowd.
Voice
in
the crowd, yeah.
Where he plays a country singer who becomes...
More recently, Man of the Year and the Ides of March.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah.
Anyway, guys,
are
I hate,
point
I hate to
a
say...
Few more.
Is that it?
Yeah. It's going to be...
Cameron,
when we 55.
Give us some words of wisdom or the people out there that watch or listen to us. What do you have to say to them?
Oh, boy. On the spot. Words of wisdom. Not my forte.
Okay, something stupid. Whatever you like.
Jesus.
Jesus, that's a...
All right.
Yeah. When's the
good
last,
talk. Good
when,
talk.
When's the last time you were stuck for words?
Yeah. I'm better on the page. You know, I haven't been on a radio show, at least sober, in quite a few years.
We didn't ask him to come sober.
No, we should have given him a drink to loosen him up.
We could have opened the bar.
We should have.
Next time.
Now the embarrassing question. Do you drink or do you...
Oh, I'm a drinker. I think it's a much classier vice. Yeah.
Do you?
There's more... Well, I work in a literary profession, and it's there's
legal.
A, more of a literary precedent, you know? We got Hemingway, we got F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know?
Right. See, the problem is you're not an alcoholic.
Not yet. Close.
Yeah.
One step.
Again, tell us where to reach you. Just keep on...
Screamcraft.org or screamcraft.org/NWC, Nashville Writers Conference, April 20th through the 22nd.
Do you still have room there?
We still have room.
And
still
what advice do you give to the writers out there?
Don't live in a bubble and don't keep nursing the same script. You got to keep generating new material. New material.
So, anyway, guys, it's been fun. We run out of time.
Adios.
Thank God.
This is Stan Weisleder on The View from Over Here saying adios, goodbye, and we will see you and talk to you and watch you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
All right.